one man that I really do want to talk to about this is Dr. Michael Rubin. He's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, whose major research area is the Middle East, with a special focus on Iran. He has yesterday in the New York Post, he has an op-ed piece, "The Obama Effect: Iran's Election Result Proves the U.S. Formula in the Middle East is Not Working." He's one of the editors of Dissent and Reform in the Arab World, Empowering Democrats. And Dr. Rubin, it's an honor to welcome you here to the Paul Edwards Program. How are you?
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm pretty good, but the one thing you didn't mention is that because I'm from Philadelphia, I really do have to study the Middle East and so forth, because it's not like a good hockey team is going to divert my attention.
Well, you know, it's like a hockey match is a box. You go to a hockey game and a boxing match breaks out, or you go to a boxing match and a hockey game breaks out. That's really what's happening in the Middle East right now in Iran. You go to an election and a riot breaks out. That seems to be what's happening on the streets of Iran. Here's my question. As you've pointed out, Dr. Rubin, Iran does not make any bones about not being a democracy. It is not a democracy. So why go through what appears to be nothing more than the theater of an election?
Well, this is the thing. The Iranian government does try to lay claim to being a democracy. Now, it's not, because sovereignty in Iran comes from God through the supreme leader, and ultimately the will of the people don't matter. However, in election after election after election in Iran, the supreme leader and the state-controlled media make the most out of this idea that voter participation in this charade really connotes legitimacy upon the Islamic Republic. That said, elections in Iran are much more about style than about substance, because ultimately any of the positions for which there are elections aren't the positions of ultimate power.
Do you think that this election was fixed in favor of Ahmadinejad by the Ayatollahs over there?
I do, although I do also think that sometimes those in the many Western observers, diplomats, and journalists underestimate how the support of Ahmadinejad. There's a lot of projection. When our journalists go over to Tehran, I used to live in Tehran when I was studying. I was doing my PhD on Iranian history. Too many journalists, too many diplomats will just hang out in the more upper class intellectual centers of Tehran instead of in the slums. And Ahmadinejad really appeals to the people in the slums, the people who resent the haves. He appeals in a demagogic way to the have-nots. Now, the reason why I think that there most certainly was fraud is looking at the Iranian Interior Ministry's breakdown by provinces. There's a few interesting things. In certain provinces, the Iranian Interior Ministry is claiming that 99.5% of the people turned out to vote, and that's just ridiculous.
Mm.
That's number one. Number two, when you look at the periphery of Iran, there's certain areas where we know that Ahmadinejad is not popular. He's not popular in Azerbaijan, for example, the Iranian province of Azerbaijan, because this is where his challenger was from. And we just saw from the heckling from who showed up at events, election events and so forth, campaign events, that Ahmadinejad wasn't that popular. And if Ahmadinejad won that province, or in the neighboring province just lost by 1%, that also doesn't pass the smell test.
And regardless, it's not going to change, is it? I mean, it is what it is. We've got Ahmadinejad again for however much longer we've got him. Obviously, the Ayatollahs over there have set him up into power. Now the question becomes, how does President Obama deal with Ahmadinejad? Now that we know for sure that this is who he's going to have to deal with, how have you felt, Dr. Rubin, that the Obama administration has done dealing with Iran to this point? I mean, in your op-ed piece, you talk about a born again diplomacy that Barack Obama seems to be embracing. What do you mean by that? And what is exactly you're trying to say about how Obama has dealt with Tehran?
There's two points here. The first, what I was trying to say about born-again diplomacy, is there's an unfortunate tendency in the White House to, when a new president enters the Oval Office, to assume that the failures of diplomacy have more to do with his predecessor than with his adversary. That if only George Bush, for example, had cared more, had adopted softer rhetoric, then everything would be okay. But this is ridiculous. And President Obama has taken this to an extreme, wanting to reset every bilateral relation, famously with Russia and that button and so forth, not recognizing that diplomacy doesn't start and stop with the election of a new president.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. And now my assessment of President Obama, I've been critical. And the reason I've been critical is too often it seems that he and his advisors have conflated advocacy with analysis. They've engaged in projection, which is when they assume that, for example, the Ayatollahs in Iran think just like they do, are just political animals and so forth, and that's not the case. We have to understand there's an ideology here. Now, with Ahmadinejad's election presumably getting fixed, what Obama can't do is pretend that Ahmadinejad doesn't have the endorsement of the Supreme Leader. The Supreme Leader endorses his Holocaust denial, endorses his nuclear defiance, endorses all of his other behaviors. That much is clear, and now we're going to have to deal much more with reality.
Right after President Obama became president, he delivered, I think, a speech to the Muslim world or a television interview. I don't think it's the same one as Al Arabiya, but you'll help me with the specifics, Dr. Rubin. But did he not in some way communicate to the Iranian people that that he viewed the Ahmadinejad and the Supreme Leader, the Ayatollahs, as the legitimate leaders, governmental leaders of Iran? And was that not kind of a break from what past American presidents had done?
You're absolutely right. What you're actually, what President Obama said twice, both during his inaugural address and more specifically towards Iran in that Al-Arabiya interview, that he wanted the Muslim world at first and then Iran to unclench its fist. What you're referring to is his Nowruz address. Nowruz is the Iranian New Year, and on, I believe it was March 21st, President Obama broadcast a New Year's greeting to the Iranians, and for the first time, he talked about the Islamic Republic, the Ayatollahs, as the legitimate representatives of the Iranian people. This most certainly was a break with the past, because what George W. Bush had done before, what Bill Clinton had done, and what George H.W. Bush had done during their administrations was reach out directly to the Iranian people. Now, this really seems to have backfired, because it's the Iranian people, clearly, that we want to be on the side of right now. And President Obama prematurely started to connote legitimacy on this regime, which would do, I mean, right now they're firing on people in the streets. And I remember what this was like, because the last time we had such huge riots in Iran was back in July of 1999 with the student uprising at the University of Tehran, and I was actually in Tehran at the time. I know what these guys are going through right now.
You know, the president would have us believe that his overtures to the Islamic community and to these leaders in Iran specifically have to do with a new approach to the quote-unquote war on terror, which he has now, you know, abandoned that phrase. Do you buy that, or is there something more afoot? You know, I'm not into conspiracy theories, but is there something more beyond just merely reaching out to the Islamic community in an effort to take a different tack with the war on terror? Is there something about Barack Obama's own Muslim background that seems to now be coming out that causes him to be a little bit more sympathetic to these regimes?
To be blunt, I tend to blame President Obama's, how sheltered President Obama has been in the Ivy League and so forth. And I myself came from an Ivy League university, and that's why I see this, because within the Ivy League, oftentimes this idea of moral equivalency is preached, that that no one can say that they're better than someone else. Everything really is equal across cultures. But multiculturalism isn't just being able to drink mojitos with your sushi. Ultimately, what we need to recognize is different people think fundamentally different ways, and President Obama doesn't seem to recognize this. For example, when he made his speech in Cairo, he sort of equated treatment of women in the United States, or he equated Palestinians with blacks during the civil rights movement,
right,
but they're not analogous situations. He compared the treatment of women in the United States, or the issue of wearing a veil in France, with some of the horrendous oppression which goes on in these other states, in these other countries. Now, I think this is fully inappropriate, and frankly, it may fly at the University of Chicago or at Harvard University Law School, but it doesn't really apply to the real world. And again, I'm speaking from experience here. I grew up in Northeast Philadelphia. I went to a Quaker school for 14 years, and it was only when I was living in the Islamic Republic of Iran and when I was living in Afghanistan under the Taliban that I really gained an appreciation for just what evil meant.
Michael Rubin, my guest, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. You can visit their website at www.aei.org. It's all linked at our website at godandculture.com. President Ahmadinejad, legitimate or not, is saying to the media, number one, reports coming out through Twitter, which is interesting, that media in Iran is being restricted. The state is coming down on even foreign media outlets, and the news that is coming out through outlets like Twitter, which I find quite compelling since I myself am on Twitter. And so finally, maybe we're seeing the real value of Twitter and other media devices like that. But Ahmadinejad is, through the official media, saying, look, it's a small minority. It's just a small number of people. And yet I'm seeing pictures, Dr. Rubin, of the streets filled with people protesting this election. What should the American people, particularly those here in Detroit, and we've got one of the largest Muslim communities in America right here in Dearborn, what should we be thinking about what has happened in the aftermath of this so-called election?
Well, within Iran, there's a history of political mobilization. If you look historically, in both the American Revolution back in 1776 and in the French Revolution, about 1 or 2% of the people took part in that. Back in the Russian Revolution in 1917, about 3% of the population took part in that. In the Islamic Revolution in Iran, you had a full 10% of the country actively participating. You've had crowds this size out in the street before. Most recent, in 1999 after the student uprising, in 2001 after accusations that the government had fixed the soccer game. And so it's not uncommon to have this number of people out in the streets. What we should be looking at is whether there's any indication that the security forces are switching sides and switching and basically opposing the government and siding with the people. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I don't think that this is going to happen this time around, at least right now. The reason is, back in September of 2007, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is their elite ideological crack force, that's military force, decided to reorganize. And instead of projecting that the greatest threats were going to come from an external enemy, they decided that the greatest threat in the Islamic Republic would come from a velvet revolution. So they broke down this guard into 30 different units, one for each province and two for Tehran. They do not station people from that province in that province so that they don't have to worry about someone deciding they don't want to fire on their family. And therefore, what we're going to see is something that's more akin to Tiananmen Square. Mm. Now, what I would hope is that this is a basic issue of freedom. It's a basic issue of liberty. It's a basic issue of a fight against tyranny. And the more people that speak up on behalf of the Iranians who are boldly going out in the streets, the better.
Are we seeing enough U.S. media covering this? Do you think the U.S. media, the mainstream media here in the United States, is doing its job in informing the American people of what's happening in Iran today?
Indeed, I think we are doing a pretty good job. The problem is, in a country like Iran, and we saw this back in 1999 during the last 10 years ago, during the last round of large-scale protests, is that the Iranian government controls the access, it controls visas, it prevents people, if they are already in Tehran, it prevents them from going outside of Tehran, and therefore the media is constrained. Oftentimes, like you said, we get the best information when it comes out from Iran via things like Twitter and then can be consolidated and put back in. That said, one of the greatest values right now are all those radio services such as Radio Farda, which is Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Persian language service, and Voice of America Persian service, where Iranians are now getting their news from, BBC Persian as well. Now, if I could just add one thing about BBC Persian, it was ironic that back on, I guess, Christmas Day, the Channel 4 in Britain decided to let Mahmoud Ahmadinejad give an alternative Christmas address. And as he was giving the address, the Iranian authorities were closing the BBC Persian's office for not, I mean, basically because they didn't like the message that BBC Persian was giving.
Irony indeed. Our own president, President Obama, is on the record as saying Iran has a right to pursue non-military use of nuclear power. In the wake of this election and what we're seeing in the streets of Tehran today, what are the immediate threats to Iran's neighbors and especially to Israel?
Well, when it comes, there's a couple different issues. Everyone has seen pictures of mobs of Iranian protesters screaming death to America. Oftentimes these are state-sponsored, quote-unquote, spontaneous rallies and so forth. But when Iran faces internal unrest, oftentimes we see a situation where the Iranian government tries to lash out against an external enemy. The reason is, historically and culturally, Iranians are fiercely nationalistic. They do rally around the flag, and so diversions work. Now, because of that, there have been a lot of concerns, not just in Israel, even though that's what we focus on in the West, but, for example, Bahrain, which is an Arab nation in the Persian Gulf. It's actually the only island Arab nation. Iran has taken to deciding that Bahrain shouldn't be an independent country anymore, and they've been calling Bahrain Iran's province. This is a parallel to the way Saddam Hussein once talked about Kuwait as Iraq's 19th province, and so many different people in the Persian Gulf are very shaky about what's going on in Iran, especially the less stability they have, the more they fear that Iran might lash out. Now, if Iran did have the capacity to have nuclear weapons, the concern would be exponentially greater.
Does Barack Obama have it in him to side with Israel in this fight, if it comes to that, between Iran and the nation of Israel? It seems like Netanyahu and Obama are on different sides of the same coin on what to do about the defense of Israel.
Frankly, I'm not so sure that Obama does. At least we can all agree that there's a great deal of uncertainty about what President Obama thinks. Now, if you are in Israel, however, you look at that uncertainty and you combine that with the fact that while in the United States, we see the Iranian challenge as a strategic challenge, Israel sees it as an existential threat, which means Israel may decide, especially after this election, that they have no choice but to intervene much more directly, perhaps with military might, because they're not so sure that diplomacy is going to work, and they're not sure that the United States has the wherewithal to treat Iran's nuclear challenge seriously, or at least effectively.
So the average person driving the Lodge Freeway here in Detroit, Dr. Rubin, is saying, why should I care about this? I mean, what does this mean to the average American?
What this means to the average American are a couple things. Most of our oil, for example, does not come from Iran, and indeed most American oil doesn't come from the Persian Gulf. But oil is fungible. So if a conflict did break out in the Persian Gulf, you would be talking about perhaps 40% of the oil coming off market, at least for a short time. So just enjoy filling up at that gas station when oil is $9 a gallon.
Yeah.
It's not only that issue, but every time this, at least in the past half century, when one nation has invaded another nation with the stake of annexing it, when it was North Korea trying to take over South Korea, North Vietnam trying to take over South Vietnam, Iraq trying to take over Kuwait, and so forth, Serbia trying to take over Bosnia, the United States has intervened. It's what's preserved, if you will, an order in which liberal democracy, freedom of religion, liberty, and so forth could thrive. What Iran is doing is starting to threaten this very order, and Iran brags openly about how they are expanding their influence, for example, not only in the Persian Gulf, but also in Africa and in South America. Do you know what the largest embassy in in Latin and South America are right now?
No idea.
It's the Iranian embassy in Managua, Nicaragua.
Mm. That's close to home, isn't it?
That is close to home. And the other important thing to remember about Iran is while many people will say that it's a pragmatic country and that we don't have to worry about this religious radicalism, the fact of the matter is the Islamic Republic is much more pragmatic the closer it is to home. The further away it gets from its borders, the much more ideological it becomes. Therefore, for example, you have two countries along Iran's border. One is Armenia, the other is Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan is a Shiite Muslim country. Armenia, of course, is a Christian country. Who does the Islamic Republic of Iran side with? Mm. It sides with Christian Armenia against Shiite Azerbaijan. However, you go to Argentina, which is halfway across the globe from Iran, and Iran has been very much involved in terrorist attacks in Argentina. The further away you get from Iran's borders, the more ideological Iran's behavior becomes. And unfortunately, when Iran decides to act up, it often acts up with terrorism, and it's been responsible for the deaths of numerous Americans in that way.
Well, Dr. Rubin, I so appreciate you taking some time away from your vacation to join us here. Dr. Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and you can learn all about him. His op-ed in the New York Post yesterday is linked at our website at godandculture.com, along with a link to a recent article also that he wrote on this very subject. And you can link to him at www.aei.org. Excellent stuff here, Dr. Rubin, and I look forward over the next several weeks as we see this develop to have you back. I hope you'll consent to do that.
Oh, I'd love to. 25
minutes after the hour.